I want to finish today talking about death and dying in the afterlife, and especially focus today on Easter Sunday and how that theological event and is important in Christianity, but I think is unique in all religions and all philosophies, and how it brings at least to a close what we've been speculating on in my mind. That the event of the death and resurrection of Jesus is the ultimate event of the Christian year, which is really the verification, if you will. Jesus said, I will die and be born again, and that was the kerygma. That was what was crucial in terms of people believing in him. And the notion of the resurrection brings some interesting kinds of things into our speculation, because what it suggests is that the body is important. And it's astonishing to me the kind of bad press the body has gotten in Christianity, how much it's been downplayed, how much the flesh has been downplayed as a source of evil, if you will, as a source of sin, as the place of sin. And yet, Christianity professes a doctrine that says the ultimate end, the ultimate meaning of life will be the resurrection of the body. So it's very important to focus then on what the meaning of that would be in relation to death and dying in the afterlife. Now, there's no question that the belief of Christianity, anyway, is that there is a life after death. There is a resurrection of the body. There is something more to come. And that Jesus walked that way before us. So when the poet says, "Strange is it not that of all the myriads who before us passed the door of darkness through, no one returns to tell us of the road which to discover we must travel to." In the case of Christianity and Jesus Christ, the answer is he did return. And he did walk that way before us. And that is our hope. Now, the question that I posed to you 5 weeks ago, though, was not so much the question of is Jesus our moral exemplar, which is what Anselm taught about the redemption. He said the greatness of this act is that it showed us this obedience, this love, this loving obedience, that he loved us even to the death of the cross, that he loved us no greater love than this has any person, that he lay down his life for his friend. And preachers have used that very powerfully, both for good and ill in some cases. Ill in the sense of making people feel awfully guilty that he shed his blood for you. That kind of stuff that used to have me squirming in my seat. And I didn't think I'd done anything. I just a sort of an innocent little kid. Some big, mean-looking giant shaking his finger at me. And while obviously Jesus was an exemplar, that is an example. There is an example there. And interestingly enough, it's an example that seemed to be something that he himself didn't want to do. That is, it was a moral act. It was a decision. I have never been as possibly, the whole time as when I was on a cruise in the Holy Land, as moved as when I was in the Garden of Gethsemane. And what moved me there was the thought that he sweated blood here. He was really in a state of anxiety. That knowing a little bit about psychosomatics, when Luke, the physician, describes Jesus as in this condition, the Greek word is a condition of anxiety. Really, he was really scared. And even to the point of edema, there is known phenomena of people getting so tense that they bleed. And so he was really scared. That's what that says. And I can identify with that. I can identify with someone being that frightened. Not to the point of sweating blood, but certainly that there's a humanness there that is appealing. And so this act of death, Jesus didn't understand it either. He didn't have some profound theological notion about why his Father had chosen death. And the question that I posed to you 5 weeks ago is, what is there then in the nature of death, as death, that makes that the divine choice? Of all the human behaviors, any human behavior would have redeemed us. You can't say that death's a better behavior than birth. You can't say that an act of love in his life or bringing in social justice in the world is a lesser act than dying is an act. You see the question, how the question focuses, why death? What is there in the nature of death that made that the proper vehicle or the choice of God for his Son for salvation? And his Son didn't understand it. So it's not a question of just a moral example, an example of he was obedient, and we can all be motivated by that. There's something more profound than that in that question. So we began probing death, and the first thing we got to 4 weeks ago was the denial. But this is a really interesting question. No one can get to it because everyone's denying. There's so much denial of death that we never even think about such a question. And as far as I'm concerned, I was saying to somebody last night, they were asking me where I was going. I was in Corpus last night, and I had to leave at 5:30 this morning. I said, I'm finishing my series on death and dying. I teach it every year at Calmer. It's the most important thing I've ever done. It's the most important tapes I've got. Not one of the best sellers. By a long shot, but for me personally, in terms of my own existential life, this is the most important material. In terms of my own theological understanding, this is the most important material. This is the question. There is no more profound question. There is no more ultimate question than this. The nature of death. What is death? Why death? There's no more ultimate question than that. So the issue then that we looked at was that our denials of death cover our fears of death. Our fears of death are our fears of life. That's what we got to, since none of us know anything about death. Experientially, no one's died, so how can you be afraid of something you don't even know about? And no one has come back to tell us other than Jesus, and none of us talked to him right after the return. And all we have are the witnesses, but even there, the accounts are kind of fuzzy. So as far as my experience is, no one has ever died and come back to talk about it and told me about it and said, John, here's what you do, and here's what happens along the way. So we know nothing about death. What we know about is dying. We know about passages. We know about being in a womb and being born. The shocking reality of what that must be, of living in this... It's a good little frame for death. Of living in this interuterine life and then being born. We know something about that passage and the passage from infancy to toddlerhood and the passage to elementary school and the passage to high school and these life passages to marriage, to the 20s, to the 30s, to the middle age crazies, to the whatever. We know about those passages. Those passages are about dying. We know that our bodies die, that all the cells change every so many years. So we know about dying. Intrinsically, we know about dying. What we don't know about is death. Our fears of life, our fears of death, which aren't fears of death, they're the fears that come from hallucinating about dying, are fears of life. So the value of looking at death is to see where you're stopping yourself from living. The whole value of meditating on death is for life. Is for life. Because as I begin to realize that my fears of death are my fears of life, then I can take action. But as long as I think it's death that I'm afraid of, then I don't understand that I'm stopping my life from being lived. So we came to all that last day, and I left you then with the question, and then we talked about grieving as the way of integrating personal death appropriation. You have to grieve for yourself. In order to accept that I'm going to die, even though I don't know what it is, I have to go through the process of grieving for me. And so the death appropriation goes through all the stages of the terminally ill. What Elizabeth Kubler-Ross found when she dealt with dying people, they went through all these stages. What Lindemann and Freud and others found when they dealt with grieving people, people who were grieving for someone who had died, then in terms of personal death appropriation, we have to grieve for ourselves. And part of the reconciliation and the centering of your life, in my opinion, is to do this piece of grieving for you. Is to do this piece of grieving for you. To accept your own personal death is to stand in the center of life much more sober and much more centered. So it's a very important issue to deal with. Now, that still leaves the question of what is death? What is there in the nature of death? And what I have gone to in trying to work this out is the only data we've got about it. And the only data we've got about it are people like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I'm reading you from an address that she gave here in Houston. After working with dying patients for many years and learning from them what life is all about, what regrets people have at the end of their life when it seems to be too late, I began to wonder, what is death? Nobody ever defines death except in physical language. First, it was no heartbeat, no blood pressure, no vital signs. Then it became more sophisticated and added EEGs and became a several-page description. But all that's still too insufficient. One of my patients has helped me find out how to begin to research what death is. And with it, naturally, the question of life after death. Mrs. S. had been in and out of her intensive care unit 15 times, never was expected to live, but always made a comeback. In one of her hospitalizations, she could not get to Chicago. She was hospitalized in a local hospital. She remembers being put in a private room very close to death and could not make up her mind whether she should call the nurse because she suddenly sensed that she was moments away from death. One part of her wanted very much to lean back in the pillows and finally be at peace. But the other part of her needed to make it through one more time because her youngest son was not yet of age. Before she made the decision to call the nurse and go through the whole rigmarole once more, a nurse apparently walked into her room, took one look at her, and dashed out. At that moment, Mrs. S. saw herself floating out of her physical body, floating a few feet above her body. She was very surprised at seeing her corpse in that bed. She made some funny remarks about how pale she looked, and then, to her utter amazement, she described how the resuscitation team dashed into her room. She described in minute details how they worked on her, who was in the room first, who was last, what they wore, what they said. She even repeated a joke one of the residents said, who was apparently very nervous, hadn't appropriated his own personal death, who started to make jokes. In the meantime, while everybody worked very desperately to bring her back to physical life, she floated a few feet above her body and had only one need, one wish, to tell them down there to cool it, to relax, to take it easy. It was okay. Now, those are her own words. She could perceive absolutely everything that was going on, but they could not perceive her. And then she gave up on them. She was declared dead, and 3.5 hours later, she made a comeback and lived for another year and a half. Okay, that's a pretty heavy piece, and that particular, Kubler-Ross started talking about this case years ago, and that ushered in a flood of this kind of material. In my classroom, she says, this was our first account of a bed patient who had had this experience. This then led to a collection of cases from all over the world. We have hundreds and hundreds of cases from Australia to California. They all share the same common denominator. They all are all fully aware of shedding their physical body, and death as we understand it in scientific language does really not exist. It is a transition of some kind of state of consciousness where you continue to perceive, to understand, to laugh, to be able to grow. And the only thing that you lose is a relationship to your physical body. Okay, well, that's her explanation of that. Now, after she published this, a number of books came out. One of them was by Dr. Raymond Moody called Life After Life. And as far as I'm concerned, Moody's book is probably the best that's ever been done on this. It's a very careful study. It claims nothing. It doesn't claim that this proves the afterlife. It simply offers a phenomenological witness that corroborates Mrs. S., that literally hundreds of people have been pronounced dead. In fact, there was one in the paper about 4 months ago. Guy was pronounced dead. He was out of consciousness, no heartbeat, no pulse for something like 10 minutes. And when he came back, when he revived, he made an account very much like this, that he'd been totally aware of everything that had been going on. But what Moody did is he took these hundreds of cases and he made a composite. And what I'm going to read you is the composite account of people who've been pronounced medically dead but who have been resuscitated. And nobody had, this is not one person's account, it's a composite account. Although many people had identical experiences. And so this is what he writes. This is the composite account. A man is dying, and as he reaches the point of greatest physical distress, he hears himself pronounced dead by his doctor. He begins to hear an uncomfortable noise, a loud ringing or buzzing. And let me say something real quick because I don't want to forget it. There are people who have also been in these states of 5, 7, 10 minutes who recount nothing. So there's other data to say that when people are pronounced medically dead, none of this happens to them. He begins to hear an uncomfortable noise, a loud ringing or buzzing, and at the same time feels himself moving very rapidly through a long tunnel. After this, he suddenly finds himself outside of his own physical body, but still in the immediate physical environment. And he sees his own body from a distance as though he is a spectator. He watches the resuscitation attempt from this unusual vantage point and is in a state of emotional upheaval. After a while, he collects himself and becomes more accustomed to his odd condition. He notices that he still has a body, and he hears a beeper. He notices that he still has a body, but one of a very different nature and with very different powers from the physical body he has left behind. Soon other things began to happen to him. Others come to meet and to help him. He glimpses the spirits of relatives and friends who have already died. And a loving, warm spirit of a kind he has never encountered before, a being of light, appears before him. This being asks him a question, non-verbally, to make him evaluate his life, and helps him along by showing him a panoramic, instantaneous playback of the major events of his life. At some point, the person finds himself approaching some sort of border or threshold, apparently representing the limit between this life and whatever. Yet he finds that he must go back to the earth, that the time for his death has not yet come. At this point, he resists, for by now he is taken up with the experience in the afterlife and does not want to return. He's overwhelmed by intense feelings of love and joy and peace. Despite his attitude, though, he somehow reunites with his physical body and lives. Later, he tries to tell other people, but he has trouble doing so. In the first place, he can find no human words adequate to describe these experiences. He also finds that other people scoff, so he stops telling other people. Still, the experience affects his life profoundly, especially his views about death and its relationship to life. Kubler-Ross says, "No one of my patients who has ever had this experience was ever again afraid to die." Now, the thing that is very interesting about this, and again, it's not presented as a proof, it's a piece of phenomenological data, is that it was not until somebody like a doctor, a psychiatrist like Kubler-Ross, began to publish work like this that people felt confident enough to come out with it. Because our culture is so a priori Newtonian. I mean, it's unbelievable. People will dismiss this kind of material without any investigation whatsoever, because they have decided intellectually that it can't exist. And even in the case of Kubler-Ross, who many feel has flipped, because in another place she claims that Mrs. S. visited her, that she met her on an elevator, and it was at a point in her work where she was quitting the work on death and dying, where she was working with this Negro minister who she was very angry at. They were in a big ego conflict, and she had told him she was not going to do it anymore, she was going to quit this work, and that Mrs. F. said, "I've come back to tell you that you must continue the work on death and dying." And she got her to sign a letter that she had so she could send it to the minister so she could have proof of her being alive. Now, you can imagine what some of the scientific community has done with that. And then there were the big reports recently, a few years ago, in Time magazine of this minister that was with her was having some kind of spirit seances where girls wound up having intercourse with the spirits, who turned out maybe to be this minister. There were a number of little things like that that seemed to be associated with Shanti Elav, which is the place she has. My real recommendation, I have visited with her personally. I have great admiration for the woman. The best thing that I could tell you is go experience what she does and then make a decision. Don't make a decision just by hearsay. Now, public people get terrible things done to them. I know, personally, stories about people that are just absolutely untrue, and I don't know how they start sometimes or where they come from, but they do. They happen. And I sort of thought back the other day and realized that I'd done some of it, too. Sort of passed on stories that I didn't know whether they were true or not. They just made good press, you know, and good gossip. So I'm not denying that I don't know what happened out there with that minister. What I do know that I have not really seen any inconsistency in Elizabeth's work. She does believe in guardian spirit. She believes in the afterlife. She believes that she has scientific evidence that there is a contact with spirit beings, and that her people, the people that she's worked with, have shown her that, and that it is as a scientist that she's saying it. And the thing that I believe is that unless somebody's done 15 years of work with dying people, I don't know that you have a real ground to dispute what she's saying. That, you know, to a priori dismiss it, having never been worked with a dying person or interviewed somebody who's been through one of these events, I think is pretty bad science. But you have no evidence yourself, you just hallucinate that it's wrong. And, I mean, there's a tendency in all of us to do this because either you've had the heavy scientific mode, or you've even had some religious people scare you that this kind of thing is demonic or whatever. And I just think it's worth listening to, letting it seep into your own psyche, to your own experience. You know, after all, what I just described to you is very much like the meditation that I took you on for higher consciousness, if you remember. We did it all disassociated, where you view yourself. And so if there really is a higher consciousness, which is connected to all things, and that's the premise we've been working on, with some pretty good scientific support for it, it's not impossible to think of someone at death going out of that ego consciousness. Now, that's not the position that I'm presenting to you today, but I'm just, you know, the job of theology as opposed to philosophy is to try to bring people motives of credibility for their faith. What theologians do is try to show you that your belief is not irrational, that the belief in the afterlife has a lot of substance to it. It's not some crazy irrational thing that you're called on to believe fideistically. That is, and I hate fideism myself. I hate it to see people who are so brainwashed that they believe and couldn't give you one reason why they believe. That's the Jim Jones people. And that bothers me greatly. In fact, I teach disobedience. I teach disobedience. That is, I teach people that it's important to let children confront and let them be angry and not make little robots out of them, because that's how we produce a world for Jim Jones. That's how we produce a world of people who are so beat down in their passive aggressiveness that they'll conform to any guru who comes along who seems to be powerful. And what I do also believe is that when my son rebels, he needs to take the consequences. He needs to experience fully the consequences of his rebellion so that he knows and he has the experience of what it means, so that he can gather data about the decisions he's going to make about his life. But this sort of blind faith I do not buy by any means, and nor did any of the great fathers of the church or any of the theologians buy it. They were brilliant people who knew the science of their day, and they knew the philosophical traditions of their day very, very well. Now, Kubler-Ross says a couple of other things that I think are worth presenting to you. And again, she certainly may be on a sort of a boundary between overdoing and glorifying death. I don't personally come out of this glorifying death. I'm still scared of it. I still don't want to do it. And even if you see a world of lights, I'm still interested in food and sex and a few of those things. And I'm not sure I want to make the passage yet. And unless I got some little inkling that maybe there's some of that on the other side, you know, I hate to leave what is known to go to what is unknown. And to me, it gets a little far out when people are just waiting to die. And I don't say Elizabeth is, but that you can get that if you're not careful out of this. And several of you have sent me some articles that have been done on her that present her in a pretty lunatic, on a pretty lunatic fringe. I just would encourage you to read her stuff yourself. Go to Shanti Alai if you can get a week someplace and experience her before you make a final decision. The most impressive part, she says, of my work has been with dying children. And in my opinion, this is the most impressive part of her work. Almost all my patients now are children. I take them home to die. I prepare the families and the siblings in order to have children die at home. The biggest fear of children is to be alone. Remember what I read you from that 13-year-old boy who was dying? That is that, you know, he expressed that brilliantly, that his fear was dying alone. Not to be with someone. All the children were asked who were dying, who do you most want to see when you die? And inevitably they would say my mama or my daddy, or my mama and my daddy, or, you know, the people that were there, the mothering people. Kubler-Ross says, at the moment of transition, you're never alone. You don't know that now, but by the time of the transition, your guides, your guardian angels, people whom you have loved and who have passed before you, will be there to help you in this transition. She says, we have verified this beyond any shadow of doubt, and I say this as a scientist. There will always be someone who helps you in this transition. Most of the time, it's a mother or father or grandparent or a child if you've lost a child. It is sometimes people that you didn't even know were on the other side already. I had the most moving experience, she said, the gift of an Indian woman who was in her 90s, who came all the way to one of my lectures in Arizona and traveled an enormous distance from her reservation to share with me this incident. I had very few incidents of Indians. They do not talk about these things, and they are really my favorite people. This woman introduced me to her daughter. The woman was about 90, the daughter about 70. They came together to my workshop. The 70-year-old daughter told me that her sister was killed on a highway hundreds of miles from the reservation by a hit-and-run driver. Another car stopped to minister to the sister. The dying woman told the stranger that she wanted to make very, very sure to tell her mother, the dying woman, tell my mother that I'm all right, and tell her that I'm especially all right because I am with Daddy. Now, the patient's father had died 1 hour before on the reservation, hundreds of miles away. But somehow, that father died before that daughter and met her, and the daughter could have had no knowledge of his dying. We've had one case of a child, a 12-year-old, who did not want to share with her mother that it was such a beautiful experience when she died, because no mommy likes to hear that her children found a place that's nicer than home. That's very understandable, she says. But she had such a unique experience that she needed desperately to share it with somebody, and so one day she confided in her father. She told her father that it was such a beautiful experience when she died that she did not want to come back. What made it so very special, besides the whole atmosphere and the fantastic love and light that she saw, was that her brother was there with her and held her with great tenderness and love and compassion. And after sharing this, she said to her father, "The only problem is that I don't have a brother." Then the father started to cry and confessed that she indeed did have a brother who died 3 months before she was born, and they never told her. So it's a very interesting phenomena that Kubler-Ross continually asked these children, "Who do you want to see when you die?" They would say parents, but never, never did a child see a parent in one of these near-death experiences or medical death experiences unless the parent was already dead. They never saw anyone in this experience unless they were already dead. They certainly didn't see the people they wanted to see. So, again, this is a piece of phenomenological data. It's a kind of data we've never had before about death. And to me, whatever else you do with it, don't dismiss it without investigating it. Again, I don't claim this to satisfy my mind that there's unequivocally a life after death. It's not a compelling intellectual proof, if you will. On the other hand, I more and more, as I grow older, do not know of any compelling intellectual proofs for anything. And as I grow older, objectivity is an illusion. The more I understand, and in every workshop I do on communication, I spend the first couple of hours showing people that there is no such thing as objectivity. That you think you're being objective about the person you live with, or your children, or your parents, and that's simply not true. That every interpretation you're making is partly a projection and a hallucination out of your own experience. And some of you remember when I did the story of Farquhar and Guinevere and the Alligator River, where the bridge fell down and Farquhar went across the river and Guinevere couldn't get across the river, so she had to ask Sinbad if he'd take her across, and he said he would if she slept with him. And she decided not to do that, so she asked her best friend Ivan if he'd take her across, and Ivan said he'd like to, but he didn't want to get involved. He had too many personal problems himself. And so finally one day she did the deal and with Sinbad. And true to his promise, old Sinbad took her across the river, where she met her beloved Farquhar, and they lived happily for several months, building their tent in the woods and having a great time, until one night guilt overcame Guinevere, and she told him, and he went out of his gourd and went crazy and kicked her out of the tent. And as the story came to its end, she was wandering down the beach where she met a kind of a natural woodsman named Sluggo. And Sluggo, as the story ended, went to the tent and beat Farquhar up. And what you are supposed to do with this story is rank order these people in terms of the person in the story that appeals to you the most to the person that appeals to you the least. And first of all, I've never done this with a group of people, including senior partners for Deloitte, Haskins, and Sells, to little old ladies at First Methodist in their 70s, that everybody in the story didn't get a vote as number one. As a matter of fact, the ladies at First Methodist put Sinbad first. And dang near blew me away. I'm in the tabernacle at First Methodist, and about 17 hands went up on Sinbad. And I said, my gosh, I'm a little taken aback by this. And the little old lady stood up and said, man, he told it like it was. You know, I figured, well, okay, you know, but it's interesting. One day I had been doing this for years with people, but never did the deal myself. It's real easy to be the boss and kind of facilitate everything and not have to do it yourself. You know, you can get away with murder being a therapist because you don't have to work on yourself. You just get to take care of everybody else. A lot of people choose it because of that. There's a lot of sick therapists running around. Just only recently did the dentist overtake the psychiatrist in suicides. Suicide is the highest cause of death among dentists, but it previously was among psychiatrists. Now, that's very interesting. I can understand dentists, but I can't understand psychiatrists. I mean, working with all that and people angry and won't brush their teeth. Anyway, but the interesting thing is that as you rank order, though, somebody asked me one day, they said, who would you rank order first? And just without thinking, I said, Ivan, the best friend, who wouldn't take her across because he had his own personal problems. And, I kind of thought about that, and suddenly it dawned on me that that is so relates to my own personal life, that one of the biggest problems I have is saying no to people. That I have a lot of please me, want to be loved, and so I please people and do things I don't want to do. And take on things that I don't want to take on. So suddenly I realized that I was identifying with the person in the story that was most like what I wished I could do, is to tell somebody, no, I'm not. I can't counsel your brother. I'm so busy right now, I'm going crazy. And take on one more person is insanity. But frequently I don't do that. I say, oh, sure. And then my stomach knots up because I don't know how I'm going to do it. Anyway, the bottom line is that every time I've done that, all the people are chosen, and everybody will relate their choice to something personal. It's not objective. It's subjective. We think we're making all these value judgments objectively, and we're not. We're making them out of the context of our lives, and out of the context of the only thing we have to go on, which is our own experience. So you see, and then in modern times, we've had the whole notion of scientific knowledge challenged by Abraham Maslow and others. Rosenthal, who did the experiments at Harvard, where he told the Harvard graduate students he had these specially nurtured rats that had high IQs. Now, how he ever got them to buy that, I don't know, but... And that, you know, he knew they were going to get better results with these rats. And they did. And hell, Rosenthal had got them out of the cellar. And changed them about four times on them. Weren't even the same rats by the end of the experiment. He kept sneaking in there and sneaking new rats in on them. Pretty hard to tell which are old rats and which are new ones. But what he proved pretty conclusively is that the experimenter is always affecting subjectively the outcome of the experiment, and that this so-called objectivity is just an illusion. So you see, when we come to start looking at this kind of material, and then there's another book Moody's done called Reflections on the Afterlife, which is some more data. Once he published Life After Life, he got literally hundreds of thousands of letters of further experiences. It's almost like somebody opened the floodgate because our culture had said you can't have those kind of things. They're crazy if you have them. Nobody would talk about it. Once it became more fashionable and okay to talk about it, people began to write about it. And you cannot believe the number of people I work with who are psychic, but who have never allowed themselves to be. I mean, clients who are just as psychic as can be. I bet you there's all kind of psychic people in this room right now. Highly developed psychic abilities, or not highly developed, but psychic abilities that are there but in rough stages. But nobody's ever given you permission to develop that. In fact, it was, you know, it was memorization and logic that have dominated all of our education. So very little permission has been to develop the intuitive, imaginative side of you. Now, the other thing that's important in the question of death is the material body. That out of that Newtonian, Cartesian, Descartes, the Cartesian world, that there is matter and there is spirit and they're connected at the pineal gland, is what Descartes said. And he had these two worlds, res materia and res cogitans, the world of matter and the world of spirit, which is just an old secularized form of Manichaeanism. There's a world of spirit and there's a world of matter. The Essenes had this. A lot of the early Christian sects had it, that the body is the temple of the devil. The Manichaeans, the Cathari in the 12th century. This has always been around. It's around right now. I remember a guy coming to me that was a part of about a 400-couple wife-swapping group. And this guy was a card-carrying elder in the Baptist church. And so would his wife. They both accepted Jesus as their personal Savior. Sorry, John. They're after me. And I don't want to leave you hanging on this one. And this guy and his wife came with, I'm not going to tell you what the presenting problem was. It was a sex act that went on in the group. And, you know, I don't know how you could differentiate where she's going to bed with 15 or 20 guys in the group, but it was a certain kind of sex that he was just indignant about. And at a certain point in the counseling, because my mother in my head was going crazy with all this, of how they could put these two worlds together, you know, to go sing on a hill far away on Sunday, and I should make something funny up about this, but I can't think of anything, and then be involved in this group on Saturday night and have his wife sleeping with 10 or 15 other men in front of his very eyes. And what came out one day is the woman said something like, well, of course, all sex is of the devil. All flesh is of the devil. And there's nothing we can do about that. The only thing we can do is accept Jesus as our personal Savior and know that we're saved in the Spirit. And you begin to see this schizophrenia, and there is a religious schizophrenia that can take place where you've got these two worlds. You've got this one world over here where you're saved in the Spirit, and this other world where intrinsically you can't be saved. So you just go with it. Not bad, huh? And that's exactly what the Manichaeans did. If you go read Augustine, St. Augustine, when he met Mani, the early teacher in the 3rd century or 2nd century, they had these orgies because it didn't matter. I mean, anything you did on that level was of the devil. All you had to do was believe. I believe right in the middle of the sex act, see, and it was okay. And this gets real weird from a psychological point of view. And there's all kinds of stuff that has come out under the auspices of God that can get pretty schizzy. And the thing here is that the body has gotten this bad press. And what we're beginning to understand is, you see, there is no world in which there's something over here called body and something over here called spirit. Baba Ram Dass says, all the body is in the soul, not all of the soul is in the body. Now, we don't know exactly how to conceptualize this, but what we're trying to do is maintain that body and soul are not two separate entities at war with each other, that in some way they're of the same substance. You can even hold it from an energy point of view, that body is a lower frequency energy than consciousness is. Consciousness is a higher frequency energy. That's Jack Swartz. If you read Human Energy Systems and the work of Swartz, he talks about mind, body, and spirit. And spirit is even a higher entity, something that can transcend mind and body. But the point is that we've got to get out of this dichotomizing of body. Otherwise, when you define death as the separation of the soul and the body, that means that the body was no good. It was something you just wanted to jettison anyway, so you could get out of it to get into soul. But what about the resurrection? See the problem? What about the incarnation? What about the mystical body of Christ? What about the communion body? See how dominant body is in Christianity, in the very most important things of Christianity? So you can't get away. We've had such terrible press on body. Christianity is a this-worldly religion. So we have to start looking at the body. Now, Einstein is telling us that body is energy, that matter is energy. Einstein is telling us that these gross dichotomies we do, like past, present, and future, are mental constructs. They're relative phenomena, that there really is no past, present, and future. So as we move into a world of physics, modern quantum physics, a whole lot of the way we conceptualize the body, and interestingly enough, the way some of the spiritual traditions of the East have conceptualized the body begins to make sense. Because the physics catches up now. It's almost like the physics catches up. And the physics says there isn't this dichotomy. And so what happens at death then? Do we leave the body? How is that possible? The body is an energy phenomena. It is an electromagnetic energy system. All the psychokinetic work that's being done, the work of Dolores Krieger, the laying on of hands, some of you have literally done seminars with me where we took Dolores Krieger's work, and everyone in the room experienced beyond a shadow of a doubt that you don't stop at your skin. The reason I can transfer energy to you is that if you don't stop at your skin, that I can take my hands and start moving them back and forth, and pretty soon an elasticity begins to happen in between them. You can take cotton and hold it in your hand and think certain thoughts and make certain pictures and pass it to the person on your left, and they can pick them up. We had it happen right in this room. People who had never done this before. And I've done ESP things in this room with people who have never done it before. I told you about, taking people into a deep kind of alpha breathing and holding hands in a circle. People have never seen each other before. And I had a client of mine who volunteered to move to the center of the group. And after about 30 minutes of this, of establishing a contact, an energy in the group of breathing and breathing with a noise and getting the whole group breathing with the same rhythm and the same noise, getting over the laughing, and then you have one person go to the center of the group and the other people with their eyes closed open and shut their eyes like camera shutters, and just say the first image that comes to them. Now, this girl had had a terrible, traumatic situation of a grandmother who tied her to a cross in the attic and put honey all over her body to punish her for her evilness, because she dropped her panties in front of some neighboring kid at about age four. Tied her up there for 6 hours so that the roaches could crawl on her. Lovely granny. I knew this about the child. The only thing that kept the child sane was to focus on a red rocking chair that she loved and was a symbol of salvation for her. the first six people that opened their eyes said things like attic, rocking chair, cross. I mean, this woman was getting white in the center of the group. And of course, what you do on these experiments is you go then go back to the people and try to check out their projections and hallucinations. You know, does a rocking chair mean anything to you? Do you have a rocking chair? Have you been talking about a rocking chair lately? And incredibly, they didn't know where this came from. So you see, we're beginning to get data, and then the remote viewing ESP at Stanford Research, Mind Reach by Puthoff and Targ, Silent Pulse by George Leonard, Energy Healing by Brew Joy, Joy's Way, all of this material, and tons of other that I'm not even remotely been talking about, is coming together and showing us that you can't think of body as a gross, extended, quantitative corporality as we once used to. That somehow my body energy is part of the whole universe. We're all part of it. And that to think of my soul leaving some quantity as body at death just doesn't work in quantum physics and relativity. So we already have an enormous amount of data that is challenging that old kind of idea that somehow death is this separation. Now, Karl Rahner, who is the theologian that I just admire so much, and I've quoted this essay to you for years now on the theology of death, Rahner makes the proposal in this theology that we are not a gross, quantified body, that our body is the whole world, and that our body is the vehicle of our mental and spiritual development, that we're in the world by way of a body, that you can't be a spiritual being adequately without a body. And if you think of the eight stages that I just got through on television, the idea of an inverted pyramid, that each one of these stages is a crisis, which is a time of heightened potential but increased vulnerability. So that every crisis that's met and surmounted, the world enlarges. And it's like a circle, an inverted pyramidal circle that is growing larger and larger, so that we're always coming into being and into consciousness. And that this consciousness is always emerging. And that as this consciousness emerges, our freedom enlarges and enlarges. So we're beginning to understand that body is the only way we can be spirit. And that body's the vehicle that takes us to this enlargement, to this eighth stage, which, remember, Erickson calls the stage of wisdom. Now, isn't it interesting that you don't get to wisdom till the end? Now, I want to make a parallel to you. I want you to think about something. Imagine what it is to be in a womb and to have eyes. What in the world would you need eyes in the womb for? In that state of being, eyes and ears wouldn't make much sense, would they? They only make sense in preparation for another stage. And what I think, and this is not a proof, it's just an analogy to think about, that we go all our life to get wise and then we die. Well, maybe, just maybe, that knowledge and that wisdom is what we've been going for as a preparation. As a preparation. That this knowledge that we develop over all these years with all this struggle, this love. You know, as I get older, I'm a much better lover. Not lover in bed, but a lover as a human being. I'm much more compassionate. I'm much more patient. The trivia doesn't get to me anymore. The kids got crud all over the place. It ain't that big a deal. There's more gentleness. And it really feels good, and I think it's a kind of wisdom that I know what's important and what isn't important. But it's taken me all my life to get here. I don't think I grew up till I was 45. It takes a long time to grow up. I mean, and you know, it's not made it yet, but it's better. It takes a long time to grow up and mature. And so what I'm suggesting is that at death, death has to mean something for all of this, that death is the total cumulative achievement of your personality. And so death must affect that personality in some way, not just the body. Death has an impact on the soul, and that's what Rahner says. We have remarked that it is in death and only in death that man enters into an open, unrestricted relationship to the world as a whole. See, what is wisdom? Wisdom is being a seer. You see the whole. That's what wisdom is. It's to know what is important. Cardinal Newman said, not to know the relative dispositions of things is to be a slave, but to have mapped out the universe in its totality is the boast, or at least the hope, of the wise man.